the podcast with Dr. Jim Keeney at www.jim.md.
Dr. Jim here with you. Thanks for listening. And if you haven't already subscribed, be sure to click on the subscribe button so that you don't miss any of these episodes on my website at www.jim.md. Just want to thank all the people at KFI and Bill Handel because their support has been huge. All of a sudden, getting a lot of hits here. Let's talk today about coffee and pregnancy. Should you be drinking coffee if you're pregnant? If you believe the results of a new study published this week, you would say no way. But we're going to talk about why that might not be so accurate. This study showed that women who drink more than 2 cups of coffee a day are at a higher risk for miscarriage than women who don't. Okay, let's talk about the flaws in this little experiment. You really want a study that ahead of time decides what variable they're going to change, and then change that single variable and watch what happens. So, for example, you have 2 potted plants in the backyard and everything else is the same except one of them you water with water and the other one you water with some Miracle-Gro or something like that. But everything else you keep the same. And you have a theory that the Miracle-Gro one's going to get bigger. And you wait and you see what happens. Okay, that's called a prospective study. You've decided everything ahead of time and you wait to see what happens. This study on this coffee is more like a poll. They call it an epidemiological study. They just took a poll of women and asked them either immediately after or during their pregnancy, did they drink coffee and how much did they drink? 2 cups a day, 1 cup a day. And I think a lot of people answer these questions based on what they do on an average day. They don't necessarily think back and see if their behavior changed or what happened. So it's not always 100% accurate. Next, they just recorded whether these women had a miscarriage or not. And what they found out was that women who drank more than 2 cups of coffee had twice the rate of miscarriage. Now, miscarriages are pretty common. You know, reported miscarriages are about 15% or so, 15 to 17%. But I bet there's a lot more miscarriages than that because a lot of women are pregnant in the very first few weeks. And because of probably a chromosomal abnormality in the baby, you have a heavy period, you lose the pregnancy, and you never knew you were pregnant. So the true miscarriage rate is probably much higher. And most miscarriages happen, like I said, because of chromosomal abnormalities. So I'm not really convinced a lot of the things we worry about afterwards for miscarriage anyway are a big problem. We know that alcohol and smoking result in low birth weight and unhealthy babies. And that may be true with caffeine as well, but the jury is definitely out. In the infertility literature, there's definitely some evidence that caffeine may reduce your ability to get pregnant. The goal here overall is just to try and be healthy, and that is before you get pregnant, when you think you might possibly get pregnant in the future, then after you're pregnant, you try and stay healthy. And drinking a lot of coffee is probably not a way to stay healthy. I think people in general who are willing to drink 4, 5, 6 cups of coffee a day are probably people who aren't that focused on their health anyway. Maybe that's a little judgmental of me, but that's my bias. I'm not a big coffee drinker because I don't feel like it is healthy for me. Miscarriages, we know, they occur mostly in women with advanced age and in smokers. You know, and stress probably contributes to the ability to get pregnant and miscarriage. So again, a bias probably, but I get the feeling that people who are drinking 6 cups of coffee a day are probably a little more stressed out than the average person. We got to remember, caffeine is a drug. It's a stimulant. It makes your heart rate and your respiratory rate go faster. And it does the same thing to a fetus. So that can't be healthy for a fetus to just be sitting in there breathing faster, even though obviously they're not breathing air, and having their heart rate go faster. It's affecting every cell in their body during a time when the cells are developing. I think this is something you probably, if you can just eliminate coffee and caffeine, it's probably a good idea. But if you want to have that occasional cup of coffee or cup of tea while you're pregnant, I just can't believe that this research tells me that that is not a good idea. This research specifically really shows an increased risk for more than 2 cups a day, and that's if you believe this kind of moderately weak method for doing this scientific study. Now, you got to remember, 3/4 of the miscarriages occurred in women who either drank very little coffee or caffeine or drank no caffeine at all. Women who have had a miscarriage, I don't think they have to go back and rack their brain that, oh, maybe it was the coffee that did it. I think in most cases, the overwhelming majority of cases, it's going to be a chromosomal abnormality. And, you know, that's just something else they could have added to this study that would have, I guess, been a little more convincing for me. If they noticed that fetuses born with no chromosomal abnormalities were occurring at a higher rate in women who drink coffee, now that would have convinced me of something. But they didn't do that. So we just don't know. Now, if you're having a higher rate of abnormal chromosomes in women who drink coffee, well, then maybe the damage occurred before you actually knew you were pregnant. So quitting drinking coffee may not make a difference as far as miscarriage. Again, as far as the health of the baby, probably not a bad idea to at least limit coffee intake. And if you can cut it out completely, I think it's a good idea. Now, remember, this study talked about 2 cups of coffee totaling 10 ounces. So that's a 5-ounce cup of coffee. The smallest Starbucks is 12 ounces. If your coffee comes from that type of place where you have one of those larger paper cups that look like a Starbucks coffee, then you're drinking more than 2 cups a day already. Bottom line is, while you're pregnant, moderation is the key, and do all those things you already know to try and stay healthy. All right, let's take some phone calls. First up is John, who has a question about supplements because of some problem you're having with your knee.
I broke my kneecap in an accident back in October, and it's healing. The doctor says there's still going to be pain for a couple of months, but a lot of my friends are suggesting that I try nutritional supplements, dietary supplements to assist the bone in healing and make it heal faster. And I was wondering what your thoughts were on that.
Well, here we are 3 months later. Did the doctor say that it's not healed yet? Because usually it would be healed within 6 weeks.
Well, they had to do surgery on the kneecap to repair the tendon to the kneecap. So the brace is, she's allowed some degree of movement, like 30 degrees of movement, but I need to do physical therapy and wear the brace for another 6 weeks.
Okay. As far as a pill goes, there's just no supplements that really have been shown to improve bone healing. And that's in the setting, of course, that somebody's getting enough protein, getting enough calcium, vitamin C, and vitamin D in your diet. And most Americans are. The bottom line is all those things would be replaced by just like a simple over-the-counter vitamin. Nothing fancy.
I see. So if I'm already taking a regular multivitamin, I wouldn't have to worry about taking anything else.
Right, then you're good. Now, what I would do, though, is calcium is usually kind of low in those vitamins because calcium tends to bind iron and other essential elements. So it's probably better if you take a vitamin in the morning and then maybe take a Tums at night. Some type of calcium-based antacid is probably the cheapest way to get a calcium supplement, and it's equal to any of those other calcium supplements.
Oh, okay. All right, that sounds good. Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
Sure, John. Thanks for the call. Next up is Becky, who's having some back pain. Becky, tell me what's going on.
Okay. I was diagnosed with a pinched sciatic nerve, and I had it probably for a couple of months, even before I finally went to the doctor, just because I was just tired of the hurts. That's what he diagnosed, and basically, gave me a sheet of exercise and then take 3 Advil, and he actually gave me a muscle relaxer, which I took one time and will never, ever do again. And then, then it dawned on me a couple of days ago, I've been using those icy hot pads, and they seem to really work, and I've been almost living with them 24 hours a day on 8-hour increments. Ironically, like I said, one of the other people that work in the office, I think she diagnosed herself, but she was going to a chiropractor. Sometimes you hear horror stories about what a chiropractor can do for you, and I'm not really sure the difference between what a chiropractor can do for you and then what someone who just does massages. And I did go to get a massage one time, but because of the cost, I feel like I could easily have one every 2 days, but don't want to pay for that every 2 days for however long it's going to take for the muscle to relax. So I guess my question is this, quote, heat therapy kind of what I'm doing, will that eventually relax that muscle? And also, what is your opinion of going to a chiropractor? Because this person who's going, her husband and her best friend both said that this particular chiropractor has done wonders for them and has just made them, you know, be able to do other activities without any pain.
Okay, so great question. And I'm sure that is actually such a common problem that I'm sure there's a lot of people that have similar type of issues. Yeah, let's talk about that. Your back pain. Now, sciatica usually means pain in the lower back, and it radiates down usually across kind of where your wallet would go in the back pocket. And
Exactly where the pain is at, not even in my back.
Yeah, it's not right in your back at all. It's just in the wallet area.
Yes. Uh-huh.
Yeah. So, yeah, it does sound like that could be sciatica. How long has it been going on for, did you say?
I'm going to say easily 3 months. I probably had it a month and a half before I even finally went to the doctor and said, what is going on?
Okay. So this is a very common issue. And the overall natural tendency for back pain is it'll have times when it gets better, and then it'll have times when it gets worse. And that pattern of better and worse seems to flow regardless of the treatment we do. So that's a little sad at times. But overall is we don't want to cause harm, because we know that a year from now, whether you go to a chiropractor, physical therapy, we treat you with pills, we treat you with bed rest, we stretch you on a rack, any of those things, a year from now, most people will be better regardless of what we do. Now, I don't mean to imply that you're going to take a year to get better. Most people get better within about 6 weeks. Having said that, though, a lot of the studies show, of all things, chiropractors with simple mechanical low back pain do seem to help people with their symptoms early on. And a lot of the studies show that it is similar to treating with medications. So especially if you're kind of against medications and you'd like to try a chiropractor for low back pain, I think it's a reasonable thing to try. Now, the problem is not all chiropractors are created equally.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there are some quacks out there, just like doctors. And I think there's people that really know what they're doing. So that's the hard part, is actually finding a good chiropractor.
So obviously someone who is glorifying this particular chiropractor, I mean, with at least three people saying he's fixed them, then that would obviously be a good choice to go to.
I think that would be a good choice. Now, I personally don't like when chiropractors manipulate the neck, because there are arteries that go through your, it's the only area of the spine where there's an artery that goes to your brain, the vertebral arteries. And when they manipulate the neck, I've seen three patients that have had strokes following manipulation of the neck, because it tears the artery in the vertebral column. So, you know, I'm not comfortable with that. But for low back pain, I think this is a reasonable way to go. Now, but you said you're getting pretty good relief from those icy hot pads.
Yes, I am getting complete relief. I'm just wondering, is that going to, will those actually relax the muscle to some
point
where...
You know, if those pads are working, I think they're great. What they contain is something called methyl salicylate, which is... salicylate is what salicylic acid comes from, which is aspirin.
Oh, okay.
What you're doing is taking aspirin, but instead of putting it in your stomach, you're applying it right to the area where you need it. And if that works, that's excellent. I think that's a very good way to treat it.
Okay. Okay. All right.
If that's working, if you want to try going to a chiropractor and see what happens, see what they do for you, I would at least expect maybe an x-ray before they manipulate your back.
Uh-huh.
And he won't take the x-rays from a regular doctor, because... We take, as allopath, we meaning allopathic physicians, non-chiropractors, we take x-rays lying down, because we want certain images that are very consistent, regardless of how people stand, and that way we're looking at the same thing every time. Chiropractors want to see what your spine looks like when you're under weight bearing, and so they're going to take the x-ray with you standing up, and that's why going to your regular doctor, it won't help you when you get to the chiropractor.
Okay.
Now, there's other causes of sciatica. There's a slipped disc. So if this thing goes on for more than about 6 weeks, at that point, maybe an MRI is a reasonable thing to get, to look for a slipped disc.
Okay, even though I don't really feel it in my back?
Right, because the slipped disc actually pinches the nerve. So when you pinch a nerve, it's as if you cut a wire in your wall. You don't see the problem where you cut the wire. You see the problem where the wire comes out of the wall and lights up a lamp.
Okay.
Okay, and so when you have a pinched disc in your back, you'll experience the problem wherever that nerve radiates.
Okay.
If it lasts more than 6 weeks, I would look into it. The reason I wouldn't do it before 6 weeks is because even if you have a herniated disc, most of those will heal on their own. And so even if you find it on MRI, it's not like you're going to run and have surgery on it anyway. So give it a chance to heal, and if it goes away, you don't need the MRI.
Well, it's probably been about 3 months. It was a month and a half before I even went to the doctor, and then the doctor diagnosed it as the pinched sciatic nerve.
Right.
So then it's been another month and a half since then that I've just been trying to deal with it, you know, like taking Advil, and then all of a sudden it dawned on me, oh, I'm going to try those icy hot pads. And then that has been working, and that's been relieving the pain.
Okay.
So it sounds like I probably should go back to the doctor and say, I've had this for going on 3 months now.
Yeah, I think after 3 months, it's very reasonable to get, the MRI would probably be the best test. They're always going to start with a plain x-ray because it's simple, quick, cheap, easy to get. But I think that an MRI after 3 months of low back pain is you waited a reasonable amount of time and it's time to get it. Now, on the other hand, if you're talking for people who might be just talking about a small amount of residual pain and it's slowly tapering down and you feel like it's really getting better, then you could wait a little bit longer. But if you feel like I'm not getting any better, you know, it's time to go to the next step.
So, well, thank you very much for calling me back and for all your time.
Thank you, Becky, for the call. Next up is Lisa. I understand you have a question about acne medications for your daughter.
My daughter is, she'll be 13 next month, and she, you know, of course, is getting the adolescent acne, which they all hate. And so I took her to a dermatologist, and the dermatologist has recommended Solidyne, 135 milligrams, an antibiotic. And then also a topical gel, which is called Tazorac, which is Tazartine.
Okay.
And it's 0.1%. And then obviously a benzoyl peroxide wash. My concern, and I have spoke to her pediatrician, but I want some other opinions because my concern is, you know, you hear about antibiotics and not being in the medical profession. What is the long-term effects of somebody being on antibiotics, you know, kind of just taking it like a vitamin? I mean, I can understand for a short period of time, but, I mean, she's talking that maybe it could be 1 to 2 years for being on this.
Okay, so I'm assuming what you're talking about is not just, you know, pimples. We're talking about that cystic acne, which is kind of those deep pitting acne that causes scarring and everything.
Yes, it could, that we want to, you know, get it before it gets to that point. I mean, she broke out and she has been on, I did, you know, speak to her pediatrician. She didn't see any harm with trying it out. So she's gone through 1 full month and maybe 10 days. So maybe she's been on it like 40 days. And we are now starting to see, you know, an improvement. It's definitely getting, you know, smoother. There's still some redness, but you know, again, my concern is just an antibiotic. You hear in the, you know, out there that antibiotics, you don't want to misuse them or over, have them overprescribed. And I just don't know what the long-term effects would be of this antibiotic if she takes it.
Okay.
I mean, obviously, I know there's, you know, psychological effects with acne in teens, so you sort of have to weigh that. She wasn't really to that point that it was, you know, she wasn't like, you know, crying and saying she hates her face and, you know, all that kind of stuff that I know can happen, especially with a girl, but I want to nip it in the bud before, but I don't want to put her health obviously at risk if there's other options.
Okay. So, you know, this is classic 13-year-old hormonal changes, increases, you know, the oily production on the skin, and that's really the cause of the acne. A lot of people think it's, you know, eating chocolate or something like that, which is not the case. So the problem is that there's two kinds. There's the kind of acne which is a little more mild, and I'm assuming you tried some of the basic treatments like the over-the-counter benzoyl peroxide and things like that before you went to
all that. Yes,
yeah.
You did.
And you weren't getting any results with that.
Right, right.
Okay, so, you know, then it does sound like she probably has that cystic-type acne, which is much more significant, much more severe, and it can lead to scarring and, of course, all the social implications of that. So, you know, this is a common treatment, I can tell you that. The medicine that you're using, Solidyne, that's minocycline. That's been around for a while, but just in the last couple of years, it's been repackaged in this extended-release type of tablet.
Okay.
So, and it's related to tetracycline. So obviously people who are allergic to tetracycline shouldn't take it. And the reason there's two reasons we've always used tetracycline for treating acne. Number one is it's what we call a lipophilic molecule. It's attracted to lipids or fat. So it actually is attracted to that oil in your skin.
Mm.
And so that's helpful. And number two, it's what we call bacteriostatic. It's not bactericidal. Okay, now let me tell the difference. Bactericidal means it kills bacteria. And a lot of antibiotics kill bacteria. Tetracycline right. just kind of stuns them. It takes your body then to kill it off. So it tends to have less of an effect, although it still is going to affect kind of the bacterial flora in your body, like your gut, vaginal flora that keeps you from getting yeast infections and things like that. But it's because of this effect that we don't see yeast infections and all the other complications that we often see, diarrhea from the normal bacterial killing antibiotics. So in that regard, it's a little bit better. Now, the bottom line is you can still have that kind of super infection. You're at risk for having that intestinal super infection. Now, before I get into these complications, we should just say they're relatively rare. And so you're weighing you're weighing here the social effects versus the physical effects. And of course, if you're the one in a million that gets these, then you're going to wish you didn't do it. But you know, you got to weigh the risks.
The risk at some point is that she could get some super, bug that they hear about in the news now too, and that maybe she would be, resistant to what would be the treatment, and she could be in a more serious position.
Yes, that is true. And so, one of the things that we see is it's called pseudomembranous colitis. It's caused by a bacteria called C. difficile. And the only reason I'm bringing up these fancy words is because it's on the rise, and you're going to hear this more in the news. It's called Clostridium difficile. And that C. difficile is called difficile because it's difficult to get rid of once you get it. And this does put you at an increased risk to get that, although I can tell you, I just don't see a lot of people coming in with this particular bug because they're on tetracycline or the related products for acne.
Okay.
I'm sure they gave you some paperwork about the side effects, and it's pretty there's an extensive list here. I mean, it can cause liver changes. It can cause hepatitis. It causes a little bit of change in your kidney functions. One out of four get dizziness when they're on this, but when you look at the placebo, almost one out of four had dizziness with the placebo too. So I'm not sure what to make of that.
She hasn't had any. They would have shown up after 40 days of use, right? I mean, more than likely, right?
Well, they can show up anywhere along the way, but if you were going to have any of the serious allergic reaction type side effects, it should show up earlier on. So the bottom line is, if I had a kid with cystic acne, I would probably treat him this way because I think the risk is small enough. It's a calculated risk, but you got to be going into this with your eyes open, knowing that, in the very, very, very rare circumstances, you can have some serious side effects that if you knew it was going to happen, you definitely wouldn't take the drug.
And that's what, as a mother, I don't want to be, 5 years down the line, somebody saying, was she ever on this? But now she's her life's at risk, So, and I guess just how long would you say, let's say she doesn't have any serious side effects. How long would you say, would it be safe, to keep her on this? And once you're off of it, does the acne just come right back? I mean, that's what I'm, let's say her face does clear up. Can you get off of it?
Yeah, the bottom line is that acne occurs more when you're in the teenage years, and it seems to clear up a little bit better as you get older, although that's not true for everyone. So this is not typically a lifetime type of treatment. Now, on the flip side of things, though, what you really want to know is this safe long-term on the order of years? And the FDA doesn't require those kind of studies. So this thing, this drug came out 2.5 years ago, and it's been used for acne for that length of time. And all the studies have only been done up to 12 weeks. So beyond 12 weeks, there are no studies to really know. What we depend on is what we call aftermarket surveillance that watches to see if people are reporting adverse events.
Ah, okay. So what would you do? Like, if you had a teenage, how long, if her face was getting better, how long would you say would be a good, length to keep taking it?
I would go ahead and take it until she's definitely very cleared up. And then I think you could talk to the dermatologist about what you could withdraw to see if it, if now that we've gotten her kind of cleared up, it kind of maintains a little bit better. So maybe you just could use the topical gel instead of putting this antibiotic, you know, through the whole bloodstream and system.
Right. Okay.
But it's something you kind of got to play by ear and you got to change. And so that's why this really does require kind of an ongoing follow-up with a dermatologist.
Right. And that's what we are. I mean, we're going today, in fact, even. And so, and she's also coupled it with doing some acne sort of facials, which they say that my pediatrician actually said that her daughter went through those and those helped too. So, you know, we'll try all this, but I just wanted to be very cautious and not just popping pills. I know I don't really like to, you know, give my daughter pills if she doesn't need them. You know, I don't want to treat everything with a pill, but if it's necessary and it, you know, and it outweighs the risk, then I'll do it. I have very oily skin. I never had acne, but my face is still oily today, which they say is a good thing because I don't have very many wrinkles. But,
right, yeah,
you're
going to look beautiful as you get older.
Yeah, not good when you're a teenager, though.
The bottom line is that if you're younger than 12, this has problems. So at least she's 13, she's okay. And then once you get in kind of the reproductive years, this definitely causes birth defects and it reduces the efficacy of the pill. So that's something she should be aware of as she gets older.
Okay.
All right, thanks for the call.
I heard you on the Bill Handel Show today, so that was a good thing, and I appreciate your phone call so promptly.
Thank you, Lisa, for the question. Good luck with your daughter. That's all we have time for today. Gotta run. Until next time, take care, and be sure to check out the website, www.jim.md.